Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. Hope you've had a great week. I'm here with Andy Green from Rolling Stone, with Brittany Spanos, and with Patrick Doyle. Hey, everyone.
Hey.
So, we're here today to talk about Chuck Berry. Rock and roll lost its father, and we'd be remiss if we didn't dedicate at least one episode to it. I was saying that we probably have about 5 episodes worth of material, because we're also going to be joined by Bruce Pegg, who wrote a really excellent biography of Chuck Berry, sort of the definitive one, the only one really besides Chuck's autobiography. It's called Brown Eyed Handsome Man, and I think we have Bruce on the line right now. Hey, Bruce.
Hi, Brian. Hi, everybody.
Hey, thanks so much for being here. How you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. How about yourself?
I'm okay. So you've been talking to a lot of people about Chuck Berry this week, right? You've been kind of throwing your head back to that space of Chuckland.
It's been an absolute crazy week, Brian. The news came over to me via the BBC World Service about 6 o'clock Eastern on Saturday, and I really haven't stopped since.
So tell me a little bit about how you got started on your book.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian, and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of 3 pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
Sure. It would have been sort of like 96 or so. At the time, I was a professor at Colgate University, and I was looking for a book-length research project to do. And at the same time, I was trying to figure out a way to combine my love and also my practice as a musician. And I'd always been a fan of Chuck's. Right from the word go, as a child of the 60s, I was introduced to him, like most people, through the Beatles and through the Rolling Stones. And so I looked, I just happened to go online to see what had been written about him, and was absolutely stunned to find that there was literally nothing of consequence. And you think about how many books were written about seminal figures such as Elvis and Buddy Holly. And all of a sudden it dawned on me that maybe this was the project I'd been waiting for. And so I started work on it, and 6 years later we were able to get it published.
And it's, you know, I love the way it puts Chuck into historical context, and even goes into the kind of the racial history of St. Louis and the tensions there. And, I mean, how was Chuck shaped by his times? It's a big question, but how was he shaped by his times and even the local culture that he grew up in?
Well, the area that he grew up in St. Louis was an area that was known locally as the Ville, and the Ville was predominantly a black middle class enclave, if you like. It had all the best amenities for that 1920s black society could get. It had a great high school, Sumner High School. It had a very large teaching hospital, the Homer G. Phillips Hospital, all within a couple of blocks of where Chuck was born and raised. So he had that as and a very steady middle class background as part of his life. But also, it only took a quick trip from the Ville to downtown St. Louis for him to understand that segregation was very rampant in that community, and things like not being able to ride an elevator in one of the department stores, not being able to go. A very pivotal moment in his life was not being able to go see a first run movie at the Fox Theater, which is where he eventually performed his 60th birthday celebration.
And the movie in question was A Tale of Two Cities, which is
that's correct. Yeah.
So this was all. I mean, I'm going to read a quote from him from Rolling Stone's 2001 interview with him. And there's a bunch in here. There's him deprecating himself quite unfairly, but it's interesting. "Look, I ain't no big shit, all right?" And then it paraphrases him. In Chuck's book, he has always fallen short of true greatness. Nat King Cole's diction, Maya Angelou's poetry, Duke Ellington's elegance, my music, it is very simple stuff. I told you all this before. I wanted to play blues, but I wasn't blue enough. I wasn't like Muddy Waters, people who really had it hard. In our house, we had food on the table. We were doing well compared to many. So I concentrated on this fun and frolic, these novelties. I wrote about cars because half the people had cars or wanted them. I wrote about love because everyone wants that. I wrote songs white people could buy because that's 9 pennies out of every dime. That was my goal, to look at my bank book and see $1 million there. That satisfy you? So, Bruce, what do you think of that? I mean, I think Chuck is really selling himself short there, don't you?
Yes and no. I mean, he understood, I think, perhaps better than any artist I've ever come across, that innovation in any art form, whether it be music or the visual arts, doesn't stem from like one single moment. He knew his influences. He knew his sources. And what his genius was, it was to put those things together into a package that was not only really satisfying, but also very able to connect with the teenage audience of his day. I think he's self-deprecating, too self-deprecating. Yeah, I mean, because he really did change music as we knew it at that time. But he's kind of right. He's kind of got a point. His what he did was very simple, but that made it all the more effective.
I mean, I would say, and I was saying to these guys before the show, sometimes someone can think they're doing hack work. In other words, they think that they're trying to please an audience, or they are trying to please an audience. And in the course of doing that, in the lack of self-consciousness that comes with that, you can create some of the greatest art that's ever been made, certainly the greatest popular art. And I really think that's what Chuck did. I think that he may not have considered himself a poet. He may not have considered himself a lot of things, but I think he made some of the greatest kind of American vernacular poetry in the form of lyrics. He set off, as Bob Dylan recently kind of said, it basically set off an atomic bomb that changed the way people could, you know, see music, see their lives, see the possibilities of America. And he claimed Americanness for himself as a black man. And I think that that's one of the most fascinating sort of political things about Chuck, is that by simply making a song like Back in the USA, by writing these all-American narratives and claiming them, I think was an incredibly powerful statement. So anyway, I mean, we wanted to talk a little bit about his musical development, because it started, he played a talent show, right? He sang a blues song at a talent show at his, as you said, rather upscale high school, and it was scandalous, but very acclaimed by the kids. And he also noticed that the dude who played guitar with him got as much attention as him, because he hadn't played yet. So then that's how he started playing guitar, right, Bruce?
That's the story that he tells, that he played Jay McShann's Confessing the Blues, which, you know, interestingly enough, was not really one of those down and dirty gut bucket blues from the Mississippi Delta, but a more sophisticated version of the blues from Kansas City. So right there you see that sort of tension that you alluded to earlier in that quote that you gave, where, you know, he wasn't quite he wasn't a bluesman, but he certainly appreciated it. And that's just the first shot, if you like, of his career. His sister Lucy was a classically trained mezzo soprano opera singer, and so he obviously understood some of the more refined and sophisticated kinds of music that were available. And his father was a deacon in the Antioch Baptist Church right there in the Ville, so he would have been exposed to Baptist gospel music as well. So you take all that stuff together, and another element that he introduced into music too, in his music, and really forms the backbone of rock and roll, is I'm sure, I can't tell you the station, but I'm sure he listened to a lot of country music as well that would have been going around at the time. So, you know, he's always made no bones about the fact that you take all of that stuff and put it all together, and which is, again, what, like I said earlier, what his genius was, and that's rock and roll right there.
So he started gigging at local clubs to a black audience, and he started playing what he called hillbilly songs to this audience. And I wonder if we could play Matt "Ida Red," which is a song by Bob Wills that Matt has ready, and let's hear that for a minute. And now let's play "Maybelline" by Chuck Berry, and we can hear perhaps a similarity. Maybelline, why can't you be true? Oh, Maybelline. So we didn't even play the vocal part of "Ida Red," but there's a it's not just a coincidence. I mean, Chuck was directly inspired, as he's acknowledged, by this song by Bob Wills. And Bob Wills is actually, as a side note, it's really interesting that's Western swing. And Western swing as an influence of rock and roll, I think, is overlooked a little bit. And even to the extent, when I asked B.B. King about where he first heard single note guitar playing, and where he, and also just actually specifically bending, the bending of notes and with vibrato, he actually pointed to the steel guitar player who played with Bob Wills. So yeah, it's a very interesting, there's a really interesting sort of, on a lot of levels, musicological and even racial, this racial back and forth. So Chuck was playing, before he did Maybelline, he was literally, and it's kind of lost to history what he was, which country songs he was playing. I think we can probably be pretty sure he's playing "Ida Red," given that he went in the studio. So how did he get to Chess Records?
As you said, he had come up with his own version of "Ida Red," and he went up to Chicago and actually met, or his version of the story is, he met Muddy Waters at a club in Chicago and said, "Hey, where can I go and sell this music?" And Muddy, of course, being a Chess Records artist, immediately sent him to Leonard and Phil Chess. He played them the song. And Phil, from all accounts that I've heard, was absolutely blown away by it. He thought it was incredibly unusual. He heard that big beat that we just heard, and he saw lyrics that were about, you know, young love and cars, and he said, "This can't miss." So they brought him back a couple of weeks later with Johnny Johnson, his piano player, and cut Maybelline. And within about a month or two, a copy of Maybelline got into the hands of Alan Freed, the New York DJ, who story goes, played it for 2 hours nonstop on his evening radio show. and you know, the rest, as they say, is history. Chuck, even though he'd been playing for quite a few years, now was an overnight sensation, and Freed took him under his wing and sent him out on tour, on one of those big old package tours that they used to have back in the day, and away the career went.
So let's talk about Chuck Berry as a guitar player for a minute. Patrick, Chuck was drawing on earlier stuff, like the guitar player who played with Louis Jordan. What else have you...
Influenced by Charlie Christian. I know that he was influenced by T-Bone Walker a lot, who doesn't get a lot of credit.
Yeah, T-Bone was the biggest one, I think.
Yeah. And then, like you said, the pedal steel, that double string thing that Chuck really brought into focus, and what became the signature rock and roll guitar solo, Johnny B. Goode, and all those had a double string break. The way he soloed, it had this full sound with the Gibson guitar that really just kind of grabbed you.
Bruce, what else is there to say about the kind of the formation of Chuck's guitar style?
The other thing that you can hear is what he's doing rhythmically. Many years ago, I was lucky enough to meet him very briefly and shook his hand. But one of the things you immediately noticed about Chuck Berry when you did that is he had a hand that was like a bunch of bananas. His hand was huge. His hands were huge.
I would say Mick Jagger pointed that out to me because this movie Jazz on a Summer's Day, which Mick and Keith are truly obsessed with, Mick saw how big his hands were in that movie and said, oh, no wonder it's so easy for him. But sorry, go on.
That's right. And so what he was able to do, and I'm not like a theorist, so I can't tell you the exact terms, but first thing is he's able to bar chords up down the fretboards, which makes those simple 1-4-5 progressions that all of his songs pretty much have very, very easy to play in any key. So he was able to play in keys like C and B flat that most guitarists avoid because they're a little harder to play. So that's the first thing. The second thing too is that if you hear Johnny Johnson's piano, Johnny was a boogie woogie piano player. Boogie woogie goes back to the 1920s, and it has that really driving, undulating bass line, the dun da dun da dun da dun da dun da dun, that kind of sound. And what Chuck was able to do, because he could bar chords, he could play that on his with his left hand up and down the fretboard. So now, not only, you know, you add that rhythmic quality to the double string stuff that Patrick just talked about, and you've got a whole vocabulary for guitar that had never appeared prior to Chuck Berry coming on the scene.
The power chords. I mean, nobody else was really playing power chords before Chuck.
So we were talking about the formation of Chuck Berry's guitar style, and Bruce was very rightly pointing out that, weirdly enough, one of the main influences on his rhythm style was, in fact, his piano player, Johnny Johnson. Now, Johnny Johnson was also very much in a tradition of piano playing, and I wanted to play a song called Honky Tonk Train Blues by Mead Lux Lewis for a second, and we'll hear, listen carefully to what the piano's doing, and it may sound familiar. Cool, and then the first song where Chuck kind of introduced that is a roll over Beethoven. Let's play that for a second. What we're hearing is actually the Johnny Johnson had, in between, created a song called Johnny's Boogie that was basically an evolution of the Mead Lux Lewis song, right, Bruce?
That's the way I'm hearing it, yeah.
So this then goes to an interesting question about Chuck, which is one of the many controversies that surrounded Chuck Berry, which was the extent to which Johnny Johnson was an author of these songs. And I thought the kind of most tragic Johnny Johnson quote was, no, I didn't write these songs. I don't know how to write music. I just played it. And it's like, no. But it is more complicated than that. Johnny Johnson was not completely the full secret author of the music to Chuck Berry's hits, right? I mean, that's just actually a vast exaggeration.
I believe so, yeah. And of course, you know, the Johnny eventually took Chuck to court in the late 1990s, early 2000s, and the judge tossed the court case out. Although the judge tossed it out for the statute of limitations, he said that, you know, the suit should have been filed many years earlier. You know, my take on it is that, you know, Chuck would have known this music. It would have been around.
Right.
You know, so I mean, Johnny, I don't think Johnny introduced him to it. You know, and clearly the lyrics with Chuck, I mean, you only have to hear Chuck talk or read his autobiography to know that he's writing lyrics the way that he talks and the way with the rhythm and the observations that he has, that's him. It's, you know, and I think if Johnny needs to be remembered, because he certainly did have a part to play in all of this, there's no question in my mind. But I think really Johnny's genius was just to provide that really great driving rhythm behind Chuck. Was he a side man, which is, that's how he was eventually inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which is a very deserved category for a lot of people. But, you know, was he an arranger? Perhaps. He may have done some arranging work, but was he the author? I don't believe so.
It seems like he probably, quote unquote, wrote the music to "Wee Wee Hours," which is a Chuck Berry blues song. I mean, by the both their account, doesn't that seem like, yeah, the case? So there's cases like that where, and even again for Roll Over Beethoven, it seems like Johnny Johnson started playing that boogie, Chuck adapted it to guitar and added the lyrics, and in that sense, maybe Johnny does deserve credit for helping inspire at least the signature Chuck sound, right?
We can certainly point to Johnny, but like I say, I don't think Johnny would have been the only way Chuck would have heard that music. I'm sure he would have been aware of it,
right,
much earlier than that. But I think, you know, when those two were on the bandstand at in East St. Louis in the 1950s, I would imagine Johnny would be that would be Johnny's basic repertoire, and Chuck would probably, well, in fact, we know that Chuck initially was hired to be Johnny's guitarist, and of course the roles got flipped very quickly.
It's the ultimate band hijacking of all time, possibly. Yes.
Yeah, really. I mean, who knows Johnny Johnson today? Sadly, you know, because Johnny was a great piano player back in his day, and certainly Eric Clapton and Phil Lesh and a lot of other people, Bob Weir, felt highly enough about Johnny to ask him to join them on numerous occasions. So, you know, Johnny was no slouch on piano, but was he the author? It's a tough case to make, I think.
Patrick, what were you going to say?
That one of the points that Keith Richards makes in the Hail Hail Rock and Roll movie about Chuck's 60th birthday, which is the greatest documentary of all time, but he makes the point that a lot of Chuck's songs are in
piano keys,
strange,
yeah,
piano keys, A-flat, yeah, and B-flat, which is why every pickup band had a very difficult time playing with him, because you'd expect him to play in A or E, but they're in these weird keys, so, and those are much easier to play on piano. So he was probably in the room as Chuck was writing these songs, so he probably deserves a little more, I think.
Right,
but again, not to argue the point, but I mean, Chuck would have been aware of those keys. You know, any guitar player would have, who grew up listening to Charlie Christian and people like that, and any kind of jazz music, would have been aware of those keys. And certainly, like I say, with Chuck's ability to be able to bar chords on the fretboard, he can move up and down the fretboard. Doesn't play after playing things in first position, where some of the stretches would have been a little harder.
He wasn't a big user of open strings. So there's, as Bruce points out in his book, Keith made a kind of an offhand remark one day when he was tired with the cameras on him, and that led to this lawsuit, to everything. But anyway, I love that we're caught on we're deep into the hottest debate of 1956 here. But one of the things that struck me both reading Chuck's book and reading your book, Bruce, and just is, you know, Chuck's experience of racism throughout his life, but specifically on his first tour, where he got his first taste of Southern segregation and of Jim Crow and all the kind of stuff that was still alive and horribly well at that point. And there's a lot of different things. There's one moment in his book where he's playing to a literally segregated audience. One side is white and the other side is black. And he, the white side liked Maybelline and the black side didn't. So then he played Wee Wee Hours aiming at the black side, and then was trying to find, I mean, there should be a movie of this, by the way. It's just extraordinary. And then there were also times when the segregation broke down and people would literally, of all races, would end up dancing together, which is like a beautiful metaphorical thing that actually happened, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, yeah. So. I mean, he and Little Richard really did amazing things to advance desegregation, but just by being themselves and just by being entertainers and showing that their music crosses racial boundaries. And the interesting thing to me is that Chuck initially in his career realized how hard it was going to be for him to break through. One of the things that people, unless you really know Chuck Berry's life, don't know about him is that he was a photographer. He learned photography from his cousin, Harry Davis.
A videographer, too, unfortunately, but yes, go on.
that's a whole different story. But one of the things he was able to do, his cousin Harry took his own publicity photos, and one of the things Chuck did very quickly was underexpose the photographs or the negatives so that when he developed them, the pictures would show him to be having a much lighter skin than he actually had. Mm. Terrible commentary on how to break through into the music business in the 1950s. But, in that business, you did what you could to get your name out there. And that led to some real problems as he went down the South, particularly once he started venturing forward on his own and getting booked into clubs where they were expecting a white artist, only to find out that they booked a black man.
Yeah, there's literally a story in his book where he shows up for a club gig, and they're like, I can't even repeat what they said, but they're like, basically, mm-hmm. we thought you were a white guy. No, you can't play here. Which is about as horrific and blatant as it gets. I was also struck by in your book, and this has managed to not stick to Jerry Lee Lewis's reputation, but I think, Elvis Presley has been kind of, to my knowledge, falsely tarred as a racist. I really don't think he was. Certainly not outwardly. But unfortunately, the Jerry Lee Lewis said something terrible to Chuck Berry. So that was appalling.
Yeah, I'll give Jerry a half a pass on that one, because you got to remember that Chuck was a good 10 years older, and when Jerry Lee hit in 57 or 58 or whereabouts it was, he was a young punk kid out of Louisiana. He didn't know anything, he tried to strike up a rival with Chuck about who was going to finish the show when they went on tour with Alan Freed. And Chuck, to the way it was told to me by the tour manager on that particular tour, was very gracious and said, "Hey Jerry, if you want to finish the show, I don't care." But Jerry got a little nasty, and there was a little backwards and forwards between them. And Jerry's father, as it was told to me, pulled a knife on Chuck. But it's my understanding that those two reconciled fairly quickly afterwards, and they had a fairly decent relationship. They probably weren't buddies or anything like that, but they certainly did, had a fairly good professional working relationship from that point on.
I think we're going to take a minute and play some audio of Chuck Berry himself talking. This is from Patrick. You attended sort of a little press conference at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Tell us a little bit about it.
They did a tribute concert for Chuck in 2012, tied to his birthday, his 88th birthday. And Merle Haggard played, and DMC from Run DMC. It was just basically everyone who could have possibly been influenced by Chuck. And you got to see the range of the people he influenced. And he came and he played. It was not a great set, but he was 88 years old. It was just remarkable to see him at that time. But he gave a pretty rare interview. I was talking to the guy who owns Blueberry Hill, where Chuck played for 25 years, and he went with Joe Edwards, and he went with Chuck everywhere. And he told me that Chuck didn't agree to do this. He wasn't planning to do it. And I traveled there just on the chance that it might happen. And I guess, Chuck tried to wiggle out of it right before it happened, Joe was saying, and then Joe had to talk him into it, and I guess that happened a lot. But he gave a pretty amazing press conference. A few journalists in the room, and we just got to ask him a few questions.
So here's Chuck on his influences. The actual question was, what artists do you love who are in the Hall of Fame? And he kind of just ignored that question and gave his own answer. So let's hear that.
I have to say Muddy Waters. He was the first one I was introduced to. That's the reason. Oh, Blue Eyes, because of his stature. And I always thought that he deserved it. I wonder about myself again, but that's two, but I'll go further than that. I don't want to put anyone other than the other, and because I intend to stay with what is true. Louis Jordan, whose lyrics I think I try to be right under his name, as you ask me any others, he would be number, if I was number 5 or 25, he would be 6 or 26. And he would be 24 or 23. I'll get it together.
And then let's play Chuck on kind of why he thought his performance powers were declining. It's sort of pondering his future. And he was performing, but basically felt that he wasn't quite up to his old standards. So let's hear that.
I'll give you a little piece of poetry. Give you a song, I can't do that. My singing days have passed. My voice is gone. My throat is worn. And my lungs are going fast. I see better swing.
So why do you say that? Because we see you every week every month at Blueberry Hill in St. Louis, and you're on stage, you're doing your thing, everybody's having a great time.
Well, I tell you what, that is, they're having a great time from memory. And I hope that I can continue to enhance their memory, because it looks very dim, like I said, you know.
Well, Chuck, then, with saying that, do you feel a retirement is on the way? Is that what you're thinking?
That shall never be, as far as I am able to see a little, hear a little, and do but a little. I'll want to perform. I think it's in my father and my own genes.
So that was Chuck Berry himself talking a little bit, probably in one of his last, you know, probably his last sort of public interview, for sure. Bernie, what do you take away from the reaction over the last week to Chuck's death, and maybe younger people who didn't know much about him learning about him and reacting? What's your just general impression of all this?
I think that with Chuck especially, it's fascinating to think about how there are much fewer entry points for younger fans to get into him than it would be. There's less romanticization about him versus like Elvis or versus like Jerry Lee Lewis and a lot of the white artists who did a lot of the same things that Chuck did or and did it later. It's fascinating to kind of think about that and how there isn't that type of legacy built around him in that way anymore, unless you are getting into him through the Beatles and the Rolling Stones or through the artists that covered him a lot, and you kind of it's worth digging deeper. I mean, like, even cultural moments like Back to the Future, like having Johnny Be Good and things like that. Like, it's stuff like that is sort of that.
In which his authorship of the song was stolen from him.
Yeah, it's not even. Yeah. And so that's kind of, that was the most fascinating thing, because I thought it would be like this, like, more fan, like, the fanfare was from the sort of people, like the generation above mine, I feel like, and then it's like less so. It kind of got swallowed up by everything else, but it's interesting that there's less entry points for him because he is the person, like when you listen to his music, you hear the entire history of music within him.
Yeah, and I think back in the 80s, Hail Hail Rock and Roll was sort of, was the big entry point, you know? And,
but if you're like born in,
so long, yeah.
If you were born in like the 90s, I think there are a lot less entry points to get into Chuck Berry unless you're willing to dig deeper beyond like the artists who are influenced by him.
Totally. Andy, let's talk a little bit about the latter days of Chuck Berry. You know, so he just played and played and played and played on the road, one-nighter after one-nighter.
Yeah, I saw him 4 times in the past decade or so of his life, and it was very inconsistent. You know, because he would insist that a pickup band be provided. So the first show I saw him play about 10 years ago, it was people that had clearly, they had never met him before. There was just no rehearsal, and they looked petrified of him, and they played horribly, and they never knew what song was coming next, and that was very typical. It was just these endless one-night stands, or if you had the cash to pay him, he would show up. But he would travel by himself. He would bring just a guitar. And there were some nights he was great. And I remember at the last show I saw, in the last 10 minutes of the show, he was staring at his watch the whole time because he was waiting for the exact second that he was fulfilling the contract.
That is, as all good performances go, yes. That's always the sign. But Patrick, you saw him a bunch of time and love some of the shows.
Yeah, it's funny. Andy and I were going back and forth. There's a great website, chuckberry.de, which is the archive of all the tour dates. It's a great site with all the reviews. And basically, I saw him 8 times. Andy and I were at the same show at B.B. King's in 06. That was amazing.
That was amazing.
The first show I saw was in 2002. Basically, around 2000, he stopped the pickup bands as much. He did it a little bit, but it was a lot of his St. Louis band with his
family
son.
Members, yeah.
Family members and his daughter, Ingrid, they would go on the road with him. And moments that were unexpected were always the best with him. I think he broke a string at the first show I went, and he recited poetry. And it was... It was just great. I can't remember it, but anyway, he had amazing moments. Sometimes he forgot a lot of lyrics, and I think that his memory was not great.
At the very end, when I'd see him, he would ask the audience to recite the first few lines of each song, so that would sort of jumpstart his brain. So he wouldn't get the first verse, then it would kind of trail off. I mean, then his guitar at some shows is very out of tune. It was
sometimes
just,
he would play piano, and he was a really good piano player.
I had no idea. Yeah, that's amazing.
He would go over to the piano often when he would break a string, and he would start playing, and that was my favorite part of the show sometimes.
Huh. Bruce, did you know he played piano?
I did, yes, I did. And I saw him myself a couple of times. I saw him in, 2001 at Blueberry Hill, one of the shows that you mentioned. Somewhat inconsistent, but boy, there were a couple of moments. I remember Johnny B. Goode that night was just blistering. Great, great performance of that song. But then again, he was playing with, his son Butch and Jim Marsala, his regular bass player, and Bob Kuban on drums that he played with many, many years in St. Louis. So that the quality of that show was pretty decent. But I think my favorite memory is the first time I saw him, which would have been in the early 90s at Geneseo in New York, SUNY Geneseo. And so he walked on stage, and he's wearing a pair of white bell-bottom hip huggers. Now, those things have been out of style for 30 years already, but not being one to throw anything away, he thought that was appropriate stage attire. And these things, very, very tight around his bottom and nether regions. And my partner at the time nudged me, just elbowed me, and said, "Look at his ass." So I started looking at that. All of a sudden, there is a wad of cash, a bulge in his back pocket, cash right there. And it's like he just never changed throughout his whole career. Always the cash deal, and he's played that entire show with that wad of cash in his back pocket. Hysterical stuff.
We're going to play Steve Miller talking about his time playing with Chuck. Now, basically, one of the best things that happened to Chuck in this sort of latter day period of his career is like many 50s artists and blues artists, he found that the hippies were pretty hospitable to him. And he started playing at the Fillmore, backed by Steve Miller and Bob Skaggs. And here's Steve Miller talking about how they kind of backed him and helped bring him to this new audience.
We were like the band in the San Francisco scene that was able to like back up the blues guys.
Yeah.
And Chuck had, I think, had been in jail for tax evasion. I think he had gotten out of jail.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a fairly unhappy guy.
Yeah.
And Bill Graham came to me and said, "Hey, we're bringing Chuck Berry out, and I want you to back him. I want you and your band to back him up." And I said, "Okay, I'll do it, but only if Chuck Berry will come out here and rehearse for 2 days."
Huh.
And so Graham did his magic, and Chuck Berry showed up for 2 days, and we just had this great time. And we went to the barbecue joint around the corner in Fillmore and ate barbecue, and Chuck said, "Ain't nobody's going to shave or take a bath until we're done."
Uh-huh.
That kind of stuff. And we rehearsed all day for 2 days, drove Graham nuts. He was trying to do business, you know, at the Fillmore, and we were playing all day long. And we had really, I mean, we were doing, you know, there's this song he does about this house he's going to build someday. I mean, we were doing some of his most esoteric tunes. We did everything. And all of a sudden, Mercury Records said, hey, this is great. We want to record this. We want to make a live album. And a deal was struck that afternoon, but the day of that we're going to do the show, and they brought in this funky little board. And all of a sudden, this guy named Abe Kesh shows up, who is the producer for Mercury. And we're all rehearsed, and we're all ready to go, and he takes Chuck Berry outside for 10 minutes before the show, and Chuck comes back in, and he's just, like, unconscious. He's just, like, in slow motion. So they went out and had a shot or something, because it was bad, you know. And we did, I think we did four sets, and we recorded the album. The album came out pretty good. He got, I think the second night, he was a lot better. And it was like this. He looked, I mean, there were moments where it was just pure magic. And he was in the spotlight. Now, I remember this clear as a bell, standing on the stage and looking at him. And he was so handsome. And he looked like a gazelle. You know, I mean, he just looked like he could have sprung off the stage and leaped 22 feet in the air into the audience. I mean, he had that kind of, you know, coiled up energy, and he was absolutely beautiful. And we were just doing this great, great set. And at the end of the set, unbeknownst to us,
so that was Steve Miller talking about his time backing Chuck Berry at the Fillmore, which was one of Chuck's most kind of successful periods. Post 50s and post jail. Steve was wrong. The jail sentence for tax evasion came in the next decade. This jail sentence was for the Mann Act, just to correct Steve Miller a little bit. So we've been talking about the life and music of Chuck Berry, and there's so much to talk about, and I really recommend anyone who hasn't spent time with the actual music of Chuck Berry, not the covers, not, you know, just the people influenced by him, but actually listening to actual Chuck Berry, it's some of the greatest music of the 20th century. I would say start with the Great 28.
Yeah.
Right, guys?
The Bear Family box that just came out, though, has literally everything he's ever done, including the Steve Miller live album, and it's amazing.
Yes. Once you've listened to the Great 28, and then you want literally everything he's ever done.
28 like, discs.
The Great 28,000.
If you want the Great 28. But yes, no, that would be for the Deep Cuts connoisseur. And I'd also recommend reading Bruce Pegg's Brown Eyed Handsome Man. And Bruce
Thank
has
you.
Been nice enough to be with us today. Thanks, Bruce. And
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for being here. And I would also find Chuck's autobiography, which you can find used on Amazon, and hopefully will be actually available for real purchase again soon. So this has been Rolling Stone Music Now. We've been talking about the life and music of Chuck Berry. And we'll be back next week at 1 p.m. on Volume. And you can also download us as a podcast on rollingstone.com/podcast or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.